Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. It's Friday, the first hour of our program, as we have for going on low these long 3 years now. Congressman Bernie Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie segment. Today, I can say, Senator Bernie Sanders! Bernie, welcome!
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I can't tell you how excited I am, Bernie, that you are now a United States Senator. I am blown away excited.
Well, it's going to be interesting times. There's a lot of work to be done, and I just want to take this opportunity to thank all of the listeners from the state of Vermont for the strong support that we've received, and also people all over this country. We had some 88,000 contributions coming into our campaign. I have the feeling a number of your listeners were part of that group, and I just want to thank everybody.
Well, it's wonderful what you did going up against the richest guy in the state, you know, pouring millions of dollars into his own campaign. It's extraordinary. I know today that you are dealing with absolute insanity, and you can only be with us for the first few minutes here, the first 15 minutes of the show. You're going to be coming back for future programs?
Absolutely. No, I look, you know, Tom, one of the things, and you and I have talked about it very, very often, is there has to be a lot more progressive outreach to the American people. So I have very much enjoyed the opportunity of being on your show for now 3 years as a congressman, and I look forward to continue doing it as a senator.
Yeah, great. We look forward to it, too. Bernie, what's on your mind? What do you want to talk about here today?
Well, I mean, I think as everybody knows, you know, something happened that many of us thought could not happen, and that is one-party government is now ended in Washington, D.C. Democrats have gained control over the House, and just yesterday, with the victory of Mr. Webb in Virginia, Democrats gained control over the Senate. And this is extraordinary. What it means is that right-wing extremism is now dead in America. Bush's right-wing proposals will go nowhere, and that's obviously extraordinarily important. But the second half of it is, and the harder half of it is, to make sure, and this is where we need grassroots support all over America, because it's not going to happen on its own. We need to make sure that the Democrats now in control begin to stand up and fight for middle-income families, for working families, have courage in taking on the big money interests who have so much power and influence in this country. And it can happen. Let me be very clear about this. It's not going to happen just in Washington, D.C. alone. The lobbyists are very powerful. Big money is very powerful. And what we need is just a very, very strong grassroots effort to continue to put pressure on Washington to do the right thing. And if we do that, we can do some really wonderful things. If we don't, then I'm afraid that people will become just very turned off to the political process. People have a lot of expectation now. There is hope that we can make some change, and it's important that we just don't let them down.
Yeah. The folks are saying my audio sounds weird. Yes, I know, Louise. We've been talking with the board operator about that. Bernie, my audio is so weird right now. I'm gonna pretty much just turn this over to you. Where do you see Congress going? What do you see the priorities, the main agenda here in the
well,
in the,
both this
the
is what I Senate? Think, Tom. This is what I think. The American people, and what this election on Tuesday was about, were just really disgusted with what's going on in Washington in so many reasons, and we've talked about this month after month. Whether it's the war in Iraq, whether it is the corruption, whether it is tax breaks for billionaires and ignoring the needs of the middle class, whether it is the president's refusal to deal with global warming and other environmental problems in a serious way. The task right now, in my view, is for the Democratic leadership to say, you know what, we represent middle-income people, we represent working families, and we are going to stand up to those people right now who have so much influence and so much power. So what does it mean? It means the easy thing is raising the minimum wage to a living wage. That will happen, I suspect. But that ain't that hard, because 90 or 80% of the American people think that, you know, that's something that we should do, and it's just the idea that people are working for $5.15 an hour makes sense to almost nobody. But the harder thing is tackling the issues of globalization. That's not easy. You know, you and I have talked about it very, very often, the fact that we now have a $700 billion trade deficit. We're losing millions of good jobs. How, in fact, do we get corporate America to reinvest in our country, create good-paying jobs? How do we protect the white-collar information technology jobs that we have? That's tough stuff. But it is stuff that has to be tackled and achieved, or our kids will have a lower standard of living than we do. War in Iraq, man, that is huge. I think we're going to have to sit down and work it out, and we are going to have to bring our troops home as soon as we possibly can. I think it's doable, and I think Democratic leadership is going to have to stand up. You know, there's some good news. Apparently, Bush is in asking for Rumsfeld's resignation. I think Bush perceived correctly that the American people are not happy with what's going on in Iraq and not happy with the lack of morale in our military because of many of the decisions that Rumsfeld has made. We got to move on that. We got to show the American people that we can do that health care. We cannot continue to be the only nation in the industrialized world without a national health care program. It's tough stuff, but it is absolutely doable because we're spending twice as much money per capita on health care as anybody else. So it's not that we need to spend substantially more money. We need to take on the pharmaceutical industry. We need to take on the insurance industry. I will introduce or work with other people on immediate legislation for what we call prescription drug reimportation, which means that we will end the absurdity of Americans having to pay substantially higher for prescription drugs than our friends in Canada or in Europe do. This is very easy to do. This is very easy. We have the votes. We can do it. If Bush wants to veto it, well, let him explain that to the American people. So, in other words, we can lower the cost of prescription drugs in America very, very substantially. We must deal with this issue of the growing gap between the rich and the poor. And I think that means asking the wealthiest people in this country to stop paying their fair share of taxes so that we can fully fund special education. In the state of Vermont, property taxes are soaring. Very, you know, just a tragic story. You see people live in their homes, older people, they can't afford property taxes anymore. I'm sure that's true all over America. One of the things we have to do is fully fund special education. Is it expensive? Yeah. Is it less expensive than giving hundreds of billions of dollars in tax breaks to millionaires and billionaires? Yeah, it is. So I think we have to get our priorities right. I think the Democratic leadership is prepared to move forward to make sure that college education is available for all of our young people, regardless of income. Bush cut financial aid for middle-class college families by $12 billion over a five-year period. I think we should rescind that and significantly increase financial aid, and by that I mean not loans, but grants and scholarships. So there's just an enormous amount of work that has to be done. But what also has to happen, Tom, is we have got to close the gap between Washington and Main Street America. The American people have got to know what's going on, and that has to do with the media, and that's why I'm so delighted to want to continue to be on your show. We need help. I mean, I'm maybe a little bit self-serving here, but if the American people don't know what's going on, if the American people do not stand up and demand that Congress act on their behalf, you're going to continue to have a country where the wealthy and the powerful make virtually all of the decisions. So we've got to figure out ways in terms of media. How do we create a more diverse media? And I'm especially concerned about television, so that people can, in fact, hear the issues, see the issues that impact their lives. So there's just an enormous amount of work that has to be done. We have just an opportunity to do it now.
Bernie, just a real quick question. I've seen in several different media, the alternative media, mainstream media, and the European media, referring to you as a socialist. That's a word that we haven't used in the 3 years we've been on the radio. How come these stories are coming out? What's your take on that?
You know, on the ballot, as everybody in the state of Vermont knows, I am an independent. I won 8 elections for Congress as an independent and 4 elections as mayor of Burlington as an independent. But if somebody asked me, am I a democratic socialist, similar to the types of governments that have existed for decades and decades in Scandinavia and some of the European countries, sure I am. I don't apologize for that. I am. What does that mean? What it means is that government must play an important role in making sure that all of our people have at least a minimal and decent standard of living. That means health care for all people. It means educational opportunity for all people, child care for our kids. You can't have a runaway capitalism in which benefits only the people on top. Capitalism does a lot of things that are very, very good. We want to encourage that. But we need to have a strong safety net for our elderly, for our kids, for the environment, make sure that, you know, we're not poisoning the air and the water and the food that we consume. So that's what it means to me. You know,
we need to rehabilitate that word here in the United States.
Well, we need to. I mean, it has, of course, the right wing equates that with, you know, the Soviet Union or China or whatever. But, you know, as you know, Tom, in Scandinavia, they've gone a long way to eliminate poverty,
indeed,
for example.
And a fine thing it is. Congressman Bernie Sanders, I know you can't stay with us. I'll be taking calls, and we'll just make it an open Friday.
All right, Tom, I'll look forward to being with you next week.
Senator Bernie Sanders. I've got to break the habit now, Bernie. Bernie Sanders, great talking with you, Bernie. Thank
bye.
You.
Bye-bye.
We'll see you next week. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. We'll be right back with your calls. And welcome back. Yeah, if you're not part of the future, get out of the way! Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you, 21 minutes past the hour. That's just absolutely great. Senator Bernie Sanders. I'm, you know, after 3 years, maybe even a little longer than that, of Bernie being on here every single Friday, and my saying congressman, I wonder how long it's going to take me to break the habit of calling him. It's going to take at least a couple of weeks. Anyhow, it's really, today is a transition day. Bernie has, you know, a zillion things going on. And it was very, very kind of him to take time out to drop in on the program. He passes along his apologies that he can't take calls. He will be back next week taking calls throughout the first hour. But I'm here and I can take calls, so let's get to it. Dave in Eureka, California, listening on KGOE. Hey, Dave, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Oh, Tom, we haven't talked in a few months. You ruffled my feathers big time one day, but I do think top priority for Bernie, for you, for all of us, is to get rid of these damn trick voting machines. If
Well, you know Bernie's position on that.
He thinks that if we don't have faith in them, we should have faith in them. We should learn how to,
you know, he thinks we should replace them with paper.
Yes.
I mean,
yes,
he said it on this program at least a dozen times. He said, you know, these things, number one, he has two positions with regard to this. I don't want to put words in his mouth, but, you know, he's been on this program enough times. I think that I can express at least my understanding of his position. Number one, as long as there is any question or any doubt, we should get rid of them, period, and go back to paper. Number one, day one. And then day two, if we are going to have machines that are recording our vote, then the software that runs them should be open source, and the architecture of the machines should be open source. It should be completely transparent to the government, to the people, to everybody, so that we can all know that they're not, as you call them, trick voting machines.
If two more years go by and another election is coming up and these machines are still in place, I don't know. I won't be able to cope with it.
I'm right there with you, Dave. It's one of the great things about Deborah Bowen being elected Secretary of the State in your state there in California is that she's taking that position. Mark Ritchie, who we had on this program a week ago as the Secretary of State in Minnesota, he's taking that position. I spoke yesterday or the day before with the Secretary of State, Bill Bradbury, here in Oregon, and where we have vote by mail, so we don't have the super trick voting machines. There is a solid paper trail, and they're fairly confident that the machines are, you know, solid. They test them 16 ways to Sunday, and they completely control them. But still, you know, it's proprietary software, and he's not happy about that. He's calling on the open source voting or the open source software folks, and Oregon is one of the centers of it. Linux is right out of the Portland area to step up to the plate and start offering open source software for voting machines. Of course, then you got to find a voting machine vendor that'll make the hardware that'll run the open source software. But I think I think this is an issue that even Republicans are starting to get flipped out about. But now that the Democrats have control of the House and Senate, I think it's going to go someplace. Dave, thanks a lot for the call. Matt in Sacramento, California, listening on KSAC. Hey, Matt.
Hi. I just wanted to congratulate the senator, and he's America's senator, not Vermont's.
I agree.
And what really makes me
happy, although Vermont is very proud of him,
is that we've got 2 years to get him into the presidency. And I'm not joking.
I don't think
the independents like me in America who aren't far right or far left, and that's the majority of us, and I really believe it's time to have an independent president.
I don't disagree with you. I just
and no, I'm going to work on it.
I don't
see
think
how we go with it. And
yeah,
he doesn't have to say a word. We'll do it for him.
Well, I don't think that that's on Bernie's list of aspirations.
No, it's on mine. For him, he has to serve the country.
There you go.
Well, God bless him, God bless you, and thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Matt. I'm much appreciated. I'll take all the blessings I can get, and I'm sure Bernie will, too. He won, by the way, by a 65% majority after being outspent by his opponent, who is I believe he was outspent. He was certainly matched by his opponent, who is the richest man in the state and put millions of his own dollars into the campaign. And still, he won massively in Vermont. That's because Bernie does retail politics. He goes door to door. He shakes hands. He talks to people, and he tells people the truth. As those of you who've been listening to this program all these years know, Bernie is just an absolute straight-talking guy. Richard in Hendersonville, North Carolina. Hey, Richard, welcome to the program.
God bless us all, Tom. It's just an amazing day, isn't it?
Well,
it's an amazing week.
Let's not get too...
Oh, no, we got work to do.
All we're seeing right now is the pink on the edge of the horizon that indicates the sun is about to crack across the top. You know?
There you go.
It is not even morning, much less noon.
You're absolutely right. My question for you is simple, and I actually was going to ask Bernie because he's creating sort of a majority for the Democrats, because it's really 49-49,
right,
with he and Lieberman being the two that make it a majority. Does that give him a little more say and a little more power? I would hope that it would, because Bernie's message is the message that America needs to hear. It's Bernie's ideology is the ideology that would take America to the next level and get rid of so many of the problems that we have.
I absolutely agree with you. Whether or not it gives him more power, I frankly don't know. I think the power of an independent, the power that an independent wields is the threat to back away from the party. And Bernie would never do that. Bernie started the Progressive Caucus in the House of Representatives some 15, 20 years ago, which is now one of the largest caucuses in the House. So Bernie would never threaten to leave the Democratic Party, and that would be the big stick that he could wield. Joe Lieberman, on the other hand, might. And that's something that gives me the willies. But, we'll see. We'll see how that all shakes out. Richard, thanks for the call. We'll be back with more of your calls after this. And the news of the day, 27 minutes past the hour, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Viagra for your brain! Just don't tell Limbaugh. He'll want some.
Working together like spokes inside a wheel. They keep this country turning around. Hello, Kansas, sweet Bill Farmer, let me thank you for your time. You work a 40-hour week for a living, just to send it on down the line.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman Radio Program, fair and slightly unbalanced. Yes. By the way, at the top of the next hour, John Cox is going to be on. He's the first announced Republican candidate for president in 2008. And he's going to be telling, this poor guy, he's going to try and tell us how we need to cut government regulations and have more free trade and more power for corporations in America, and that'll help and everything will be wonderful. So that's going to be an interesting conversation. Bernie Sanders. This is the hour that normally Bernie is on with us today. All a zillion transition things that he's having to deal with now that he's Senator Sanders. Before I go back to the phone, to your phone calls, and I see the board is totally slammed, I just have to tell you a quick story about Bernie. 3 years ago, we were living in Vermont. We were doing this radio program. Must have been 4 years ago, actually, because it was there was a campaign coming up. Must have been coming up on 4.5 years ago, maybe something like that. And, or maybe it was 2.5. It must have been 2.5 years ago. And Bernie was doing a local radio program on a local radio station in Vermont, WDEV, and he had to stop doing the program because it would have been considered, a campaign contribution or something. And so we were, and at the time I was thinking, I'd like to have a politician on the radio program on a regular basis who could answer people's questions. But the problem I had was every time I'd have a politician on, I'd get all this weasel BS from these guys. I mean, they're always taking positions that were the politically correct position. If you ask them the hard questions, they wouldn't come back on the program. And I pretty much, we get solicitations all the time from senators and congressmen to be on the program, and by and large, usually turn them down because because I don't want to be in a position where I can't ask the hard questions, or where I can't have my listeners ask the hard questions
because they'll be offended.
And I can't, you know, I can't. There's so many folks out there where, you know, well, Senator, let's talk about the bankruptcy bill, you know, and it turns into a train wreck. So, but Bernie Sanders was a guy that I knew was always a straight talker, and just, you know, absolutely the guy. So we scheduled a dinner meeting with him in Burlington at this restaurant in Burlington just to get together and talk about his being a regular on my program. And Louise and I show up at the meeting, and Bernie comes in about 10 minutes late. We're sitting here in the restaurant, you know, with the menus and a cup of coffee. And Bernie comes in about 10 minutes late, his hair just wild, you know, flying all over the place, as it always does, and rushes in and, you know, pulls off his coat and tosses it on the back of the chair and yells to the waitress who's like halfway across the room, "Hey, quick!" And she comes over and he says, "Get me something with chicken in it, fast!" and she's like, "Oh, well, we have it." He says, "I don't care what it is. Just get me something with chicken in it fast because I got to get out of here." And he sits down and he says, "IBM just laid off 300 people, or IBM just cut the pensions to 300 people. We're organizing." He says, "I just got this call an hour ago. We're organizing a demonstration out in front of their headquarters in an hour and a half. I got to head over there. So let's sit down and talk and get that food over here." And it's not like, you know, imperious. It's like busy. It's like he's the most hyperactive guy I've ever met, and totally on task. And this is how he campaigns. He's all around the state, and he's working 100% of the time for the working people of Vermont, and they know it. And that's why even in the most conservative parts of Vermont, I mean, out in the woods where you see nothing but bush signs and pickup trucks with shotguns in the back, people are voting for Bernie. Because they know that he's there for them. They know that his first priority is not the lobbyists. His first priority is not the K Street Project. His first priority is not becoming president of the United States. His first priority is being there for the people. And that is why they keep reelecting him. It's just real simple. So anyway, it's one of my favorite Bernie stories. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Randy driving in Michigan. Hey, Randy, welcome to the program.
Hey, Mr. Hartman.
Tom.
Real honor to talk with you. I love your latest book. Can't wait to get some more your other books and read them. Just a quick question, and then I'll hang so other people can talk to you, and I'll just take it on the radio and answer. Do you see any campaign reform coming down the pike with the Dems being in control now?
I certainly hope so. I certainly hope so. And historically, they've been the ones who've been in favor of campaign finance reform because they realize that it's big corporate money usually lining up with the Republican Party. So to the extent that we're going to see campaign finance reform, frankly, I think we're going to see it now. What it's going to be, what form it's going to take, is hard to say. The biggest problem that we have, Randy, even with the issue of campaign finance reform, the biggest problem that we have is these Supreme Court decisions, Boston versus Bilotti, and I forget the name of the other one, but there were two major Supreme Court decisions in the 70s and 80s that basically said that corporations are persons and have the right to speak, and the free speech, and that money equals speech. And I don't think that money equals speech, and I don't think corporations are persons. And I hope that these Supreme Court decisions can be revisited or there can be ways to get around them at law. But that's a whole other issue for another show. One of these days, we'll do an entire hour on corporate personhood, one of my favorite topics, and get back to that. Joe in Tacoma, Washington, listening on Talk 1090 in Seattle. Hey, Joe.
Hey, I wanted to congratulate Bernie. I think that's great that he got into the Senate this time and got out of the House.
Isn't it wonderful?
Yeah, it is, because the Senate used to have a reputation as being a little bit more distinguished and more democratic, I guess you could say.
Well, and he has a lot more power as a senator than he does as a member of the House.
Yes. I was going to really say that although we got the sweep, which I was really shocked at getting both houses, I mean, it just was amazing, and it was a great example of when citizenry really gets out there and does something to participate. What I'm concerned about is when they go out there and make issues of health care, the reform on Medicare, all of the issues for the vets, those are all very, very important. But I think what they really should do is strategize to ward off any kind of attempt for the Republicans as a strong opposition party, which they will now become, rather than allowing themselves to be weakened, is to get the Constitution back where at least it was before Bush got here.
I agree. Roll back the parts of the Patriot Act, this Military Commissions Act, the Bush's signing statements, all this other nonsense. It needs to be dealt with, and it needs to be dealt
with
fast.
They're calling it the John Warner Military Defense Authorization Act, which basically suspends posse comitatus in a roundabout way and adds other restrictions for the states to have no control of their own local governments and responders.
Yep, no, it's absolutely all wrong, George. Joe, I absolutely and totally agree with you. And like I said, we have just begun. This is not like, hey, we've got a great victory. This is like we have a great opportunity. And that's how we have to think of it. We have a great opportunity now that we have a little louder voice in Washington, D.C. But there is so far to go on this. And the big lesson of Bernie Sanders' huge re-election victory or election victory as to the Senate in Vermont is that you look at all the Democrats across the United States who didn't win in tight races because they weren't progressive enough. They weren't enough like Bernie Sanders. They were trying to take the middle road. They were listening to the DLC. They were trying to be the corporate guys. They were trying to be Republican light, and they didn't win. There's a lot of Democrats who didn't win in this election because they didn't do what Bernie Sanders did. And then you look at folks like Brian Schweitzer out in Montana. Brian Schweitzer, the Democrat who became the governor of one of the reddest states in the United States, did that in Montana because his policies and positions are almost indistinguishable from those of Bernie Sanders. He's an absolute dyed-in-the-wool populist progressive, and God bless him for it. And why the Democrats don't figure this out? I mean, all they have to do is go to Vermont and look at how Bernie how he represents the people there. He doesn't govern, how he represents the people of Vermont and the positions he takes. And this is not rocket science, guys. Bob in Winchester, Virginia. Hey, Bob, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Just great.
Good to hear Bernie. And, one of the things occurred to me, all the right talkers and all the Republican politicians with all this kind of hollow rhetoric about originalists and the originators of this country.
Yeah, originalists is a phrase, by the way, that Scalia came up with.
Yeah, I know. I've yet to hear any of them say anything about how this last election was the true testament to the people who founded this country. This is their legacy to us.
Yeah.
The fact that they put this wonderful system of checks and balances in place.
Those liberals. In fact, our quote for the day, Bob, is from George Washington. As mankind becomes more liberal, they will be more apt to allow to all those who conduct themselves as worthy members of the community are equally entitled to the protections of civil government. I hope ever to see America among the foremost nations of justice and liberality. George Washington.
There we go.
Our quote for the day.
All right, great.
So,
thanks
a lot, Bob. Good to hear from you. James in El Sobrante, California?
That's correct, El Sobrante.
Hey, James, what's up?
Well, I just wanted to make a quick point, not to rain on everybody's parade right now and everything. I think the news has been great and everything. But let's not forget that for the next 2 years, the Bush presidency has control of much of the foreign policy as far as the diplomacy that goes on in the Middle East region and Europe. And that Iraq is just an immediate problem. And we're going to see some hearings into where our tax dollars have been going. But
I absolutely agree with you. And now Bolton's nomination is in big trouble. Because the Senate in particular has gone into the hands of the Democrats, it's going to be a lot harder for George W. Bush to get any more right-wing crank judges in or any more right-wing crank appointees. In fact, I hope Jim Nicholson, head of the VA, is in trouble now. Over at VAWatchdog.org, Larry Scott is calling for his being ousted, his resignation. But you're absolutely right. This is the beginning, not the end. You're absolutely right. And we have to acknowledge that. And we have to, be eternally vigilant. And we have to, frankly, now start moving to work the Democratic Party, to move the Democratic Party back to its roots and keep them awake and aware, as well as the United States of America. Hey, it's waking people up. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where being progressive never felt so good.
See, we live in a world of false pretense. If it don't make dollars, it don't make sense. My credit is a joke, the banks ain't lending. I ain't broke yet, but I'm showing up bending. Living in a world of false pretense. If it don't make dollars, then it don't make sense. My credit is a joke, and the banks ain't lending. Ain't broke yet, but I'm showing up bending.
Well, he ain't broke yet, but he's showing up bending.
Ain't broke yet, but I'm showing up bending.
Well, he ain't broke yet, but he's showing up bending.
We're going to do
something about that. We are going to do something about that. Welcome back for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 9 minutes before the hour, 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. And our live chat room you can get to by going to TomHartman.com. Drop in and say hi. Hang out with some of the finest minds on the whole entire Internet. It's actually, I get a lot of good information out of our chat room. In fact, I just want to tip my hat to the folks there and Sue Nethercutt, who runs it. And a lot of folks don't realize Sue is doing this out of a suburb of London, actually, in the UK. So hanging out with us every day. She does such a marvelous job. Brian in Waterloo, Iowa. Hey, Brian, welcome to the program.
How you doing, Tom?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
I was waiting for that. I got three quick comments. One, I just want to call and tell Bernie, which obviously he's gone now, but I want to tell him just to keep doing exactly what he's doing.
Yeah, I'm going to talk with him on Monday, and I'm going to pass along, you know, what happened with all the phone calls. So
yeah, and it is not in vain. In the words of George Bush, you know, the Democrats have political capital, and I think we should spend it basically, and try and move things back to the liberal side of things. I think it shows too that a lot of the Democrats won, as you pointed out a few times, on the votes and the voter turnout, and not necessarily how much money was spent. Mm-hmm. I think that should be a big eye opener to them to try and cater more towards the liberal side of things, or just, you know, the right side of things in general.
The correct side of things.
The correct side.
It is so weird that, you know, we are called liberals, or in Bernie's case, he's called a socialist, when in fact what we're calling for are just very common sense, practical, human value things that are working very well, thank you very much, in Europe, and have worked in the United States in microcosm, you know, in small portions, you know, Medicare, the Veterans Administration, things like that. We're just calling for national health care program. We're calling for decent wages. We're calling for the right of workers to have democracy in the workplace, the form of unionization. We're calling for reasonable trade policies that protect domestic industries and wages. I mean, we're calling for clean air and clean water, and let's not make more species extinct. I mean, this is not rocket science. We're calling for alternative energy fuels, so we're not junkies to the Saudi Arabians. I mean, if you think about it, the radicals are the so-called conservatives and the so-called centrists who think that the status quo is how things should be. The status quo is broken.
I agree totally.
I said, there you go.
You're right on. I think the one thing that we need to work on for 08 is having a voter runoff so that we can
instant
get a different
voting
point of view.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Instant runoff voting is vital. We've got to open up the political process, and that's where the Green Party has been so good on this. Over 300 communities in the United States, as a result of efforts by and large by the Green Party, now have instant runoff voting. And I would love to see some states go that way, and I'd love to see it happen at the national level. And again, it's going to happen when enough of us get excited about it. Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan, WTKG. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Yes, happy Friday, Tom. I did want to personally congratulate Bernie on his victory. And, you know, I don't think he should back down from this fact that he's a democratic socialist.
He never has.
I have known that all along, and I was a member of the Socialist Party, and I think we need more socialists. I mean, God bless them. I mean, like you say, it works in Europe. But here's the concern I had, and he's not there to answer now. But, you know, I think, for instance, we've got a pretty conservative guy there in Jim Webb, and I think he'll be a loyal Democrat now, and Bernie will caucus with the Democrats. And you alluded to this a little bit. Can we trust this Joe Lieberman?
I don't know. Here's the thing that will cause Joe Lieberman to stay with the Democrats is that that's where the power is right now.
Yeah, but if he switches, then it's 50-50, and Cheney would break the tie and go back to the Republicans again.
But only in the Senate.
Right.
And so as long as the House is Democratic and the people are obviously Democratic. I mean, keep in mind, if you look at the national vote just for the U.S. Senate, about 25 million people voted for a Republican, about 34 million people voted for a Democrat in the various Senate races. So clearly, that's where America's at. And I have to believe that Joe Lieberman is enough of a savvy politician, and frankly, that he understands, the notion that he's supposed to be a representative and not a leader, that he's supposed to represent the people of the state of Connecticut and in the small sense and the people of the United States in the large sense, that he will take that into consideration.
Do you think that maybe Harry Reid would have to make him majority whip or something? Or?
No, that's not going to happen, although he may end up a committee chairman or something. You know, there will probably be some sort of thank you very much, Joe. But, you know, and he's got to be stinging from being beaten by Ned Lamont. But, you know, we're just going to have to wait and see how this thing plays out. Rick, thanks for the call. I got to move along here. Roger, driving in Alabama. Hey, Roger.
Hey, Tom. Hey, remember when Mr. Bush and Mr. Cheney went before the 9/11 Commission, and they went before them, and they did not have to testify under oath.
Right, that was one of their requirements.
Yeah. Okay, my question is, when do the president and the vice president have to appear before the Senate under oath?
You know, it's only happened once, I believe, and that was a voluntary testimony, and I think it was Jerry Ford. I may be wrong, but I believe it was Jerry Ford who went before Congress and was sworn in. And so the Constitution doesn't specifically speak to this, Roger, so I don't know, and I'm not a scholar of, you know, Supreme Court precedent and all that kind of thing. I don't know. My broad take on it is that when the president takes his oath of office at the beginning of his term, he is swearing an oath, and from that point until he's no longer in office, in my opinion, he is under oath. He is under oath to we the people, and he is required to speak the truth. But George Bush has certainly seen fit not to make that the case. I mean, just 2 days ago, he admitted that he lied to the press and thus to we the people about, you know, considering whether or not he's going to fire Don Rumsfeld. So, you know, he's admitted that he's a liar. He's admitted that he lies for convenience and for politics purposes. I mean, we all knew that, but now he's out about it. I think that, you know, it's time that we should think about some sort of consequence for that, maybe. Gee, what a novel idea. Hey, we're going to be taking your calls all day and talking about the news of the day. So stick around. Also, right after the top of the hour, we're going to be speaking with the first Republican to have declared his candidacy for president in 2008, John Cox. Stick around. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone here in the People's Republic of Little Beirut, as George Herbert Walker Bush likes to refer to Portland, Oregon. Tom Hartman here with you. Broadcasting live on radio stations from Seattle to Pittsburgh. On Sirius Satellite Radio, streaming around the planet on RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, AirAmericaRadio.com. Our program syndicated by Air America Radio. And, of course, CRN Digital, carrying us into cable TV systems in 29 states. So welcome back to our program. 1-866-440-8466. It's Friday. We're just, you know, there's some news here and there. None of it seems to elevate itself to an extraordinary level. So I'll just continue on with the phone calls here and see what you have to say. Lynn Landis is actually on the line with us from Philadelphia. Lynn is one of the top four or five people in the United States knowledgeable about voting machines and voting fraud and all this sort of thing. Hey, Lynn.
Oh, hi. How are you doing?
Just great. I am forgetting your website.
I've changed the name of it to thelandisreport.com, but you can also get me at banvotingmachines.org. So
okay, banvotingmachines.org, that works too.
Yeah.
And so, Lynn, what's your sense of what happened on Tuesday?
My sense is that the numbers for the Democrats were so overwhelming that they managed to overcome what was clearly vote rigging that was going on that day.
So we did what Mark Crispin Miller suggested. He said, or what Greg Palast suggested. He said, if they're going to, they have a 4.5 million vote thumb on the scale, we need to bring 5.5 million votes to the table.
Well, actually, even it's worse than that, because Steve Freeman of the University of Pennsylvania, who's the does exit poll data surveys and analysis, he thought that the last election, 2004, had been stolen by as many as 9 million votes. They don't steal small; they steal big. And in fact, in Virginia, in the Virginia race, I got an email from Eileen Proctor. Mm-hmm. And they found in one polling precinct there were 808 votes for Allen and 51 for Webb. And there was an amendment on the ballot also, a marriage amendment, mm-hmm. that split 678 to 681. So they knew there was something wrong, and they contacted the U.S. Attorney's Office and the FBI in Richmond, and all of a sudden the tallies changed for Allen and for Webb. It came out, then they picked out numbers 808 for Allen and 551 for Webb. But there was no explanation for, what was going on here. So, you know, really it's, you know, sort of votes out of a hat kind of situation. And unfortunately, when you go to the Justice Department, or the FBI, you're really going to Craig Donsanto, who's been in, you know, sort of guarding the gates since 1970, and he actually has a policy that prohibits his investigators from looking into an election until after the results are certified.
Who is Craig Von Santo?
Oh, Craig Don Santo is, he was actually featured in the book Vote Scam. He is the head of the Voting Integrity Unit at the Department of Justice.
Oh, yeah.
And the only thing he seems to like to investigate are Spanish language issues. He does not and has never investigated any issues to do with electronic voting.
Yeah.
So, but the other
and everybody thinks that because the Democrats won, that means that the machines weren't rigged. Sorry.
No, right. All the vote flipping there, I don't know of a single case of vote flipping that went from flipping votes from Republican to Democrat. Now, there may have been, but I haven't heard of them. Yeah. It was the same. It was a repeat of before. The other thing I'd like to say is one of the things I promoted was asking people to go public, do a citizen audit kind of parallel election on Election Day. And I wrote this article over a year ago, and activists did do that in several states, and they were seeing anomalies, and it did look like there was like an across-the-board 3% shift from Democrats to Republicans in San Diego, for instance. I finally did one at my own polling place on Election Day, and I was really surprised, and this is what these activists have told me, is that people didn't mind going public with their vote. I got a 32% of the people who walked into my polling place said, absolutely, I'm going to tell you who I voted for, I'm going to give you my name and address, and I'm going to sign this thing because these voting machines really scare me.
Wow, that's great.
It was amazing. But the other thing also I'd like to warn you about is that open source thing.
Mm-hmm.
The open source is absolutely, I mean, from my point of view, will do more harm than good because it'll give this illusion of, you know, openness. And Avi Rubin, all the computer experts have assured us that you can hide secret code in a million different places, and open source will not answer that.
And in fact, Wikipedia, the German version of Wikipedia, got hacked recently where anybody who logged into it actually got a Trojan horse. But how then, Lynn, as ballots become increasingly more complex, and particularly, you know, in large states like California, and individual areas, you know, the complexity is increasing, and particularly if we go to instant runoff voting, which just seems like, you know, it begs for the use of computerization. How do we know that there is integrity to the system if we can't transparently see it?
But instant runoff voting does take place in other countries on paper with hand counts. You know, the issue is not
in Australia, for example.
Yeah, the issue is not the complexity of the ballot. It's the size of the individual precinct. In other words, if you have very complex ballots, which I think people should fight against, but if you do have that situation, then you need more people at the polling place to count the ballots or smaller precincts.
Right.
It's just a formula. Some people say, oh, you know, Canada, they can have hand-counted paper ballots because they're smaller population-wise than us. Again, it's not the size of the country or the population of the country. It's the size of the precinct.
So we just need to go back to hand-counted ballots, period. And we need to get a whole lot more volunteers out on Election Day. Like back, you know, I remember back in the 50s and 60s, my mother would show up and, you know, my dad was active with the county Republicans and my mom would go to the polling place and she'd sit there and help count ballots.
Well, you don't even have to rely on volunteers. We can treat this like we treat jury duty. You know, there is no reason.
Well, in Germany, what they do is they shut down for a day or two. They shut down most of the non-essential state offices.
Yeah.
So the Department of Motor Vehicles, you know, they deal with emergencies, but they're half-staffed.
Right.
And the people who would normally be issuing driver's licenses are over there counting votes.
Well,
by the way,
a couple of quick things, though. Dennis Kucinich did introduce House Bill 6200, which is calling for paper ballots and hand counts for the next presidential election. So he is the first one to do this because
we have to get Dennis on the program.
Right, because what we saw is not only vote flipping and malfunctions, but computers completely breaking down.
Sure.
So, I mean, people have, when I talk to people coming into our polling place, they said, just absolutely don't trust these machines. Get rid of them. In terms of people being able to see the problems that occurred, there are two excellent websites called votersunite.org and votertrustusa.org. These two websites are documenting all the problems that took place on Election Day.
Yeah. Okay, great. Lynn Landis, once again, your websites?
Is the Landis Report. That's Landis with an E, report.com.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot. Lynn Landis.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. Julian in Grand Rapids, Michigan, WTKG. Hey, Julian, what's up?
Hey. I think I may have stumbled across another progressive senator. I was listening to an interview of Jim Webb this morning on National Public Radio.
Mm-hmm.
And they asked him why he thought he won. And he mentioned as one of the issues the growing disparity in wealth between the rich and the middle class.
I heard that interview, yeah.
Yeah, and he said it has been that bad since the 1880s, and he started quoting all sorts of statistics.
Yep.
And for a while there, I thought I was listening to you.
Yeah.
And I don't know if he is progressive or not, but he certainly sounded like he might be.
Yeah, I don't know, you know, the broad spectrum of issues or the philosophical underpinning of Jim Webb, I don't know. And time will tell. But I think that what's happening broadly is across the United States is that America is becoming what we call progressive. And as more and more Americans look to Europe, I mean, there's a book published a while ago called The European Dream saying, you know, there is no American dream anymore. It's now the European dream. And everybody wants to be like Europe. Everybody wants to have national health care, strong unions, reasonable job security, a social safety net, safe retirement in your old age where it's not, you don't have to live on dog food on $800 a month from Social Security. Basically the European dream is where it's at. And I think that what you see is if enough Americans start speaking out, if we can create that wave, if we can create the parade, that the politicians will start getting out in front of it. I mean, that is the history of politics, not just in this country, but all over the world, that people so miss, is that we have to be the parade. And that's every day. It's not just Election Day. 16 minutes past the hour.
This here's a land of plenty, and plenty's what it takes to get some health insurance in these old United States. I just know I shouldn't have to go bankrupt or on the street if the cancer comes a-calling, as it might for you or me. I ran into my congressman, said, "Your Honorable, would you mind taking 20 minutes, if you ever find the time, to figure out some health care that would work as good for me as what you fellas got yourself in Washington, D.C. So if you get appendicitis or a splinter in your hand, I hope you're in New Zealand, Libya, or Switzerland, or somewhere else where they have somehow figured out a way to keep you upright till the good Lord says that it's your day."
And welcome back. Talk radio for the rest of us. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Instant runoff voting, a signature idea from the New American Foundation to give voters more influence and more choices in election, continued to gain favor in California and elsewhere as four cities strongly approved November 7th ballot measures supporting the idea. This is a news release from the New America Foundation. In California, where San Francisco became the state's first instant runoff voting city in 2004, voters in the cities of Oakland and Davis approved the idea, which would allow voters to rank their first, second, and third choices for office. Oakland overwhelmingly supported the measure by 68% of the return, meaning voters will use IRV for all local offices in the November 2008 election. The Davis measure was an advisory recommendation. Elsewhere, voters in Minneapolis, hey, congratulations, Minneapolis, we're on the air there, passed their ballot measure with 65% support. And in Pierce County, Washington, Voters supported the move to IRV with for their partisan county elections with 54% of the vote. So it's a fine thing that's going on here, a wave moving across the United States. And, excuse me, and I'd say if I could find my Jolly Good Fellow music, I'd be playing it right now. It's congratulations. In fact, there we go. Yes, congratulations to Americans for taking instant runoff voting, putting it on the ballot, and voting for it. It's a fine thing. It's a fine thing. It's more democracy for America. Dave in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Dave, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up, Dave?
I actually heard a speech by David Walker, the Comptroller General of the United States, on
yes,
Tuesday.
Yes, he's been on this program twice.
He has. Oh, that's great. Yeah. I really got the impression that his nonpartisan way of talking about all these issues and how they just relate to the finance of the country. You really, some party getting him out front and on their side and really listening to him and making what he's saying prominent is going to dominate politics for the next 6 to 10 years, because we're going to either go broke. I mean, any programs have to be run by what this guy is saying.
Yeah, he's it's interesting talking with him on the radio here a couple of times, the conversations that we've had. He points out that you can't run a country with an $8 trillion obvious on the books debt and another $40 trillion kind of hidden debt. You can't do that. You can't run trade deficits the way that we're running them. I mean, the whole thing, there's this huge house of cards, and he's willing to say it. On the other hand, some of his solutions are rather draconian. He's a fairly conservative guy. He thinks that we should cut back on all our social spending rather than raise taxes on the rich and on corporations. Corporations are using more than 50% of the commons of the United States. They're paying about 5% of the taxes in the United States. I think that's wrong. He thinks that's fine. So, you know, we have some differences. He's, as I said, he's more of a kind of a classic conservative. But he is telling the truth about what's going on with the U.S. budget, and that these numbers are being fudged, and that they've been being fudged ever since basically Nixon in 72. And in large part, and LBJ did it too, to try and cover up the cost of the Vietnam War, came back to bite Jimmy Carter on the butt big time, you know, economically, as the cost of the Vietnam War was ringing its way through the system. And we're going to see the same thing over the next 6 or 8 years, in my opinion, as a result of the cost of the war in Iraq. But yeah, David Walker's telling the truth.
Yeah, the speech that I heard, he didn't sound partisan or necessarily conservative, but he wasn't upfront about that.
Well, probably nobody asked
him. What he was saying was compatible with, you know, progressive ideas to solve these things.
Sure. Yeah, it is. I mean, the bottom line is we need to there's nothing progressive or conservative, frankly, about having a balanced budget. It's common sense. You know, it's just common sense. And so, but yeah, I encourage people to read the essays that David Walker, you can just Google him, David Walker, Comptroller, Comptroller, General of the United States. He's the head CPA for the entire country, basically. And, yeah, good point, John. Thanks a lot for the call. I got to move along. John in Centralia, Washington. Hey, John.
Hey there, Tom. Good to hear you today. And this time, a first-time caller on the national show.
Well, thank you. Nice
yeah,
to hear you.
Yeah, wonderful shows. Earlier today on the Portland show, you suggested that rather than allow himself to, you know, kind of be honeymooned and courted, Bush might, you know, act like a courted rat during
yeah.
this next term. And I'd like to suggest that we have the psychological data on this guy to suggest that he's vulnerable, much more vulnerable, I think, to cutting and running. I think this is a guy who's going to retire, going to quit in office like Nixon did. We don't have to impeach him. He's going to quit. You know, we know his military record. He's a coward and a deserter.
Well, the same thing at Yale now. We know that at Yale he didn't show up for his history classes.
Yeah.
Either got somebody else to take the test for him or got them to change the results afterwards.
Yes, and so, you know, this fits with our information of his psychology, you know, his fear of real conversations and discussions. You know, this is just something he can't handle.
Well, it's going to be real interesting, John, to see what happens when John Conyers, Congressman John Conyers, starts holding hearings into whether or not, not even whether or not, to what extent crimes were committed by the Bush administration, and who should be held accountable and how and why, and exactly what those crimes were. Because over these last 5 years, there have been a lot of crimes, not just against you and me, but against the Constitution, which is what they swore to uphold. 27 minutes past the hour.
Your cheating heart will make you weep. You'll cry and cry.
George, they're catching up with you. You gotta think he's waking up in the middle of the night going, Nancy Pelosi! Welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on the Radio Support Group of, by, and for We the People of the United States of America. The first declared candidate for Republican President of the United States in the year 2008, John Cox, on the line with us. His website, cox2008.com. John, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Thank you, Tom. Pleasure to be with you again.
Good talking to you again, too, John. I'm looking at your website. I love this quote from Winston Churchill. What's the use of living if it be not to strive for noble causes and to make this muddled world a better place for those who live in it after we are gone? Well said. Great quote.
I think there's a lot more to life than just making money, and I think the people of this country just drummed out a bunch of people in Washington who made money-seeking and power-seeking their main objective, and I'm looking to change that.
Well, I'm curious. Let's talk about some of the issues here.
Sure.
Republicans traditionally have been opposed to labor unions having a strong say in the marketplace. What's your position on, for example, the Wagner Act, Taft-Hartley, National Labor Relations Board?
Well, you're going to find me different. My mother was a Chicago Public Teachers Union member, and my stepfather was a member of the Postal Workers Union, so I believe in unions. But you know what I believe? I believe in competition, Tom, and I think one of the problems that the union movement in general has had is that their management, their top officers, have gotten maybe a little bit drunk with power, just like some congressmen that just lost their jobs. I think competition is good. So I think to the extent labor unions are there to compete with business management, that's a good thing. But they have to remember that we're in this together, and it's not just about power on one side or the other. It's about doing what's right for the workers and for the business and for our living standards going forward. And if we all have that in mind, I think we'll do a better job.
Well, that sounds all nice and sanitary, John, but the reality, first of all, you're not going to hear any disagreement from me that Jimmy Hoffa, for example, was a corrupt union leader. I mean, certainly that has happened in the United States, but that doesn't mean that unions are inherently corrupt any more than Ken Lay being the head of Enron means that all corporations are corrupt.
I agree with you.
And for every corrupt union leader you can give me, I can give you 100 corrupt corporate leaders. And
I don't disagree.
Yeah. But here's the fundamental issue, John. A corporation, an employer, not even necessarily a corporation, an employer has 1,000 things that they can put on the table or take off the table in terms of negotiation with labor. They can say, you can have more health benefits, less health benefits. We'll contribute to your 401k. We won't. We'll give you a week's vacation. We'll give you 2 weeks vacation. We'll give you no vacation. You can have a break in the morning. You can have not a break in the morning. You get paid time and a half for overtime. You get time and three quarters. Yeah, there's a million things that they can do. There's only one thing. There's only one thing that labor can say to management with which they can negotiate, and that is we will work or we will not work. And that's called a strike. And what you're saying is weasel language, no offense, but that's, I don't know how else to call it, or let's say very politically correct language, a way of saying, yes, I believe in unions, but they shouldn't have the right to strike. They shouldn't have the right to have a closed shop.
I didn't say that. I didn't say that at all. What I did say is that they should be on an even playing field, which means that Walmart, for example, should be able to give its employees enough of a benefit that they choose not to become a member of the union. And if they do wish to not become members of a union, the union shouldn't be able to strong arm its way in just so they can collect more dues.
Unions are democratic institutions, John. Unions are voted in by the workers. Corporations are not democratic institutions. They're kingdoms, basically. But a union is. So how can a democratic institution strong arm anything?
Oh, please! With a lot of litigation and a lot of laws and a lot of political pull, particularly with the massive union dues that are created that are collected forcibly, by the way. I mean, and those union dues, by the way, are being used for massive amounts of political contributions. And of course, what those do is that they buy public officials who then stilt statutes in various areas.
And all the decisions about how those union dues are used are being made by the union members because they vote on their management. That is not true of all the corporate contributions that are going to the political system. Those decisions are made by CEOs and very small boards of directors, and the workers, by and large, have no say whatsoever in how their corporation is throwing their money around.
The people who own those corporations certainly have a say because the shareholders are the ones who say, if you're going to support this organization, I'm going to sell my stock or I'm going to.
But that doesn't affect the corporation at all. If I own 100 shares of AT&T and I sell it, I might sell it to Louise. That doesn't affect AT&T. Their stock is only when the corporation does an IPO does anybody actually buy stock from a corporation.
Well, Tom, you could say the same thing about a small group of employees who are members of a union. Clearly, the majority of those union members are going to control, and if there's a minority of union members who, for example, don't want their political contributions going to Ted Kennedy or Dick Durbin, they're shut out of the process. They don't have any say.
That's called majority rules, John. That's called democracy.
So you can't have it for one and not for the other. If a board of directors decides that they're going to support one thing and not another.
But the board of directors isn't the company. The company is all of its employees. You try running a corporation with no employees, John.
Well, technically, a corporation is owned by the investors. The employees are certainly important to the whole thing, but they're not the owners.
And the fact of the matter is that the investors are routinely ignored. Anybody who is not a majority investor in corporations in America, if you've ever been to a board meeting, you know what I'm talking about, John. Come on, let's be honest about this.
I agree with you, by the way, Tom. One of the things that I would like to see as president is a way to empower small shareholders, because I agree with you. I'm an investment advisor. That's one of the things I do for a living. And I decry some of these boards of directors that are interchangeable, where one hand scratches the other, and they all appoint each other's cronies to the board, and then they approve some of these salaries and bonuses, which I believe are outrageous, and they ought to be taken to task for some of these salaries. I'm speaking to that as an investor, as an owner of a lot of these companies, that I'm not happy with the fact that a lot of resources are being used on people that should be going back into the business.
No, we agree on that. But my point is that if capital can organize in the form of a corporation, that labor should be able to organize, and it should be
able
to.
And I don't disagree with you. Okay. I've never said anything to the contrary. The only thing that I want to see, though, is I want to see businesses and labor unions on an even keel in terms of being able to influence the political process.
Let's keep in place the Wagner Act and roll back Taft-Hartley and go back to the closed shop.
Well, I don't know about that.
You're not going to go there. Hey, let's change issues here. I'm looking at your website. We're talking with John Cox, the first declared presidential candidate for the Republican Party in 2008. Cox2008.com is website. John Cox is fed up with activist judges who are damaging America and its institutions by legislating their liberal agenda from the bench and will appoint strict constructionist jurists to the courts. Please give me one example of a liberal activist judge legislating from the bench.
Oh, there's hundreds, but
how about one?
Let's talk about the Ninth Circuit and a judge who felt that God shouldn't be a part of the Pledge of Allegiance. He was basically imposing his view on what the Pledge of Allegiance should be in a public school. Shouldn't that be something that's decided locally? Shouldn't it be decided by a legislature of people in a community to decide that that's the community standard that they wish to have?
No, because it could be. It certainly could be. But the fact of the matter is,
you're all for empowering workers, but you don't want to empower individuals in a community.
No, I said that's fine. A local community could decide that, sure.
Okay.
But there's a bigger issue here, and that is that the judiciary is not responsible to we the people. It's responsible to the Constitution.
I agree with you.
And because they're responsible to the Constitution in two different places in the Constitution, in Article 2 of the Constitution, it'd be Article 3, because it's the executive branch. In Article 3 of the Constitution, it says that there shall be no religious test for judges or other senior officials. In other words, religion cannot be part of government. And in the First Amendment, it says that religion shall not be part of government.
God got inserted into the
Pledge of Allegiance in the 1950s by Joe McCarthy and his friends.
You're putting something in the Constitution that's not there. The Constitution says that government shall not establish a national religion. It doesn't say that
people in this country need to be kept free from any mention of religion anywhere in the world, okay? It doesn't say that. It just says
it says Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. Now,
exactly.
by saying under God, what about those people who believe in God's... John, listen to my sentence here. Listen to my question. What about those people who believe in God's, plural?
They could change the wording to gods if they'd like in their local community, but the court shouldn't be allowed to take that right away from them.
No, what I'm saying is that by establishing monotheism, by saying under God, what we have done is violated the First Amendment of the Constitution. I agree with that judge.
The Constitution says Congress shall make no law
respecting an establishment of religion. And if you're swearing allegiance to a nation under a monotheistic God, that's a religion.
Well, you know, you could stretch this the other way and say that atheism is a religion, and
I would.
By striking the word God, you're basically imposing a religion of atheism.
No, then you'd have to say under no God. Okay, John Cox, Cox2008.com, the website. John,
right.
Good talking with you. Good
luck. Here, Tom.
45 minutes past the hour.
5-1, baby. 1 in 5. No one here yet out alive now. You get yours, baby. I'll get mine. Gonna make it, baby, if we try.
Oh, yeah. They got the guns, but we got the numbers. We're taking over, my friends. Welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour of the Tom Harbinger radio program, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, not a chance. Ain't no way. 1-866-440-THOR, our telephone number. Diana in Santa Rosa Beach, California. Hey, Diana, welcome to the Tom Harbinger program.
Hi. Actually, it's Florida.
Oh, Florida. I'm sorry.
Now, I tuned in today to hear you say Senator Sanders, and it was a really up time.
Wasn't it?
Oh, it's great. But I went to, and then I went to the New York Times to read the news.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Melman is stepping down, and everybody's praising him. And then I came to this paragraph in an unsolicited call from James Carville. He said that the RNC did a better job than the DNC this year, Mr. Carville said. He said that Democrats succeeded because the party's House and Senate campaign committees compensated for what Mr. Carville described as the shortcomings of the Democratic National Committee.
Right.
I am furious.
This is the war between the DLC and Howard Dean.
Howard Dean went... the DLC just has a problem with truth that Howard Dean does not have.
Yeah. No, I agree. The DLC, I am no friend of the DLC. I'll just say that right up front.
We call Democrats of the leisure class.
Yes. Well, I call them Democrats of the corporate class, frankly. It's Howard Dean has worked his butt off. He came out with his 50-state strategy. They said, you're crazy. We want to focus on just a few races where we know we can win. We're going to do this incrementally. And he was like, no, the American people are with us. We just need to tell the truth. He was working to get progressive candidates out there. Rahm Emanuel and Chuck Schumer refused to give money to progressive candidates. If they had given the kind of money to candidates like Nancy Skinner and Tony Trupiano and Steve Sinton, I mean, some of the candidates that we'd had on this program who in many cases lost by a whisker. This could have been a landslide. This could have been 50, 60, 70, 80 seats instead of just 28, I think it is. I mean, there's still a half a dozen that are as yet to be counted. But yeah, Howard Dean is the hero in this thing. And it pains me to hear these guys try and spin it the other direction.
But it was an unsolicited call. It was an unsolicited call to the New York Times. Just
yeah. No, of course. That's Carville and Begala and the DLC. It's go way back. They were part of creating that thing. So I'm not surprised. Diana, thanks for the call. I got to move along here. Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff.
Yeah, I just wanted to continue with what Lynn Landis said. Lynn's a great person. I think one phrase we all need to keep in mind is decentralize or die.
Yeah.
Many things.
Well said. In fact, Jefferson waxed at length about that in his autobiography.
in his notes to himself, in his personal diary, about how he felt that the salvation of America was the ward system, that everything should be broken down to wards, you know, small local communities.
Yeah, we can handle these tasks at a small level. I mean, counting 300 ballots is easy. Counting 600,000 is tough.
Yeah.
So we divide it into small tasks. About the only place computers should be used in the voting process is, you know, county clerks do have a rational problem in that they may have dozens or many more different ballot styles that you may have to use at one precinct.
Right.
Computers can print the ballot.
Right.
But then the ballot itself should be counted.
Yeah. Amen.
So we can give access to the handicapped with a computer. We can print, you know, and give, you know, the thing is, running out of printed ballots is a real problem. So have a computer there that can print as many as you need.
There you go.
Yeah. Simple as that.
Make them fancy printers. Well said, Jeff. Thank you very much. Philip in Gig Harbor, Washington. Hey, Philip. Philip?
Yes.
Hey, you're live and on the air.
Hey, thank you. Enjoy your show. Hey, good job in shutting down the candidate. I hate it when people circumvent words saying they don't mean the things. Okay, my point real quick is one of the CIA tools is this circumvent or distract. Anyway, my point is when they say that we have to pledge allegiance to a God, instead of saying I pledge allegiance to, you know, to the country for liberty and justice, they're taking the ownership of liberty and justice and putting it on some entity. My kid can't email God. I can't vote for God, yet they want me to pledge allegiance to some entity that's not accountable for. I think it's just a trick to keep the government off the hook.
Well, it is actually part of this attempt by these guys to reinvent the history of this country. And you know, under God was, and speaking as a Christian myself, speaking as somebody who, you know, personally, I live under, well, you know, what, maybe Christianity could be argued as having gods also, you know, that you got the Trinity, right? But in any case, it has no place in government. And this was what Joe McCarthy was pushing, this thing, back in the 1950s. It was a way of saying that we were not the godless communists, because, you know, being atheistic was at the core of Soviet communism, and that's what they were, you know, they were trying to say we're different from that. Mark in Florence, Oregon. Hey, Mark, we just have a few seconds here before we've got to wrap it up. What's up?
Morning, Tom.
Hey, good morning.
Yeah, Tom, I can see no justified reason to allow Bush and his vice president to escape impeachment and proceedings by the House of Representatives. This is now fully doable given the fact of where congressional power will be in January. Yet Nancy Pelosi and John Conyers have both said in the last few days that impeachment is off the table. I'm hoping this is a strategic statement and that we will see action on this in January. This would certainly be a grave injustice considering the lies and cooked intelligence that were the basis for the Iraq War, which has directly resulted in massive death and destruction not only for the Iraqi people but as well to a lesser degree by the American people. Not to speak of various other impeachable offenses. And I appreciate your efforts, Tom. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Well said. I agree. We'll see. I hope it's a straight. You know, people say things are on the table, off the table all the time. And then, you know, other things happen. I mean, you know, it's just, it's, you know, for example.
You said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
Yeah, well, let's just remember that. Let's just remember that. It's 57 minutes past the hour. We'll be back right after the news.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. And radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Bill Clinton was campaigning for Jim Webb last week, and he had a comment to make that I thought was worthy of sharing with you and bringing back into a little bit of the news. Here, before we get back to your calls in just a minute, here's Bill Clinton campaigning for Jim Webb, raising what, frankly, I think is a really important issue.
It's not true that the Democrats are going to raise taxes on middle-class Americans. We're going to cut taxes to help people go to college and raise their kids and take care of their elderly loved ones when they're sick. But It burns me up that I had two college roommates who had a total of three sons do a total of six tours in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the only contribution I was asked to make to those kids was to expend the energy necessary to open the envelope containing my tax cut every year. And instead, this government decided to go borrow the money from China, Japan, Korea, Saudi Arabia, the United Kingdom, and even Mexico to cover the deal. Now, if you think that's good economics, you ought to vote for the guy you got there. If you want America to take a better path, you got to elect Jim Webb tomorrow.
And in that, Bill Clinton raises two issues, two really important issues. The first, for example, this from McClatchy Newspaper's Kevin Hall. This is from a week or so ago. He wrote an article called "The Rich Are Getting Much Richer, Much Faster Than Everyone Else." He says, over the past quarter century, and especially in the last 10 years, America's rich have grown very much richer. No one else fared as well. In 2004, the richest 1% of households, that's 719,910. It's only 700,000 households that make up the top 1%. That's 700,000 households with an average annual income of $326,000. Had 19.8% of the entire nation's pre-tax income. That's up from 17.8% a year earlier. This is according to a study by the University of California, Berkeley, economist Emmanuel Saez. The study, titled The Evolution of Top Incomes, also found that the richest one-tenth of 1% of Americans, that's 129,000 households in 2004, reported income equal to 9.5% of the national pre-tax income. So one-tenth of 1% of Americans got 10% of the total income for the country. Had an increase of 10% in the year 2004. However, the median or midpoint family income rose only 1.6% between 2001 and 2004 when adjusted for inflation. So what we're seeing is that the middle class is not getting richer. The very rich are getting very much richer. Now, so number one, tax policy. You know, that's something that needs to be looked at and talked about. But I think, you know, frankly, there's an even larger issue here. And that is one of the reasons why our tax policy is favoring the rich is because our economic policies, by and large, are favoring the rich, and they're favoring big corporations, and the whole thing about it is exporting the middle class, exporting jobs, and bringing in cash. Here, let me lay this up. This is from yesterday's Wall Street Journal. China's trade surplus for October ballooned to $23.83 billion. In other words, China sold $23 billion more worth of stuff to the world, more than it bought. Now, a lot of that has to do with the United States. An enormous amount of that, in fact. And in fact, here, this is from today's Wall Street Journal. September's deficit down from, now we're looking at the U.S. trade deficit. September's deficit down from August's revised $68.96 billion was still one of the largest ever. Michigan Representative Sandra Levin, a senior Democrat in the House Ways and Means Committee, said the rapidly growing deficit with China underscores the need for change of direction in trade policy. Our imports from China were $27.6 billion in September. Okay, in other words, we bought from the world almost $70 billion more than we sold to the world. A lot of that was oil. But $26 billion of that $68 billion was junk from China. The U.S.'s total deficit with China hit a record of $22.96 billion, by far the largest of any single country. In fact, China reported a monthly high. Earlier this week, China reported that its overall trade surplus was $23.8 billion, while our trade surplus with them was $22 billion. So it's almost all us. See, Japan has very protectionist policies. They're not importing as much stuff from China into Japan. They're saying, no, we're going to keep making stuff in Japan. Now, why does that matter? Well, first of all, it matters because jobs stay here if we make stuff here. And if jobs stay here, then paychecks stay here. Paychecks stay here. Those people spend that money. That money provides, you know, stimulates the economy, causes more demand for goods and services. So small business people step into that breach and say, great, I'll, you know, there's a demand for a good product or service, and I'll fill that. I'll create a business to do that. And the economy grows. This is how it's been running since the 1940s. Or since the 1930s, really, the mid-1930s. Since just after the Republican Great Depression. But there's a second reason, and perhaps an even more important reason, to have a rational trade policy where we go back to, for example, tariffs, where we say, okay, if there's a dollar's worth of labor in a pair of shoes made here, and you want to make those shoes in China, that's fine, we can't stop you. 10 cents worth of labor in China, but when you bring them into the United States, we're going to charge you a 90-cent tariff. There's a reason for that. And that reason is found in these, in this information. Right now, we're spending about one out of every $4 on imported manufactured goods. Now, we spend about two out of every $4 on services. So we're spending more than half, actually it works out to be a little more than half, of our dollars that we're buying stuff with on things that are either made outside the United States or made by foreign companies operating inside the United States. All those companies are making a profit. That profit is going where? Everybody, everywhere except America. This is from the economyandcrisis.org website, which is just an amazing resource. By shipping, what we have done is, because we're buying more stuff than we're selling to the rest of the world, the rest of the world is ending up sitting around on all these dollars. And what are they going to do with those dollars? I mean, they're dollars. Dollars are redeemable in the United States of America. So, you know, the dollars kind of circulate around the world economy, but eventually they end up back here. They have to be used to buy things in the United States. Well, what can they buy? We don't make anything anymore. So what is the rest of the world buying? I mean, if we're buying from the rest of the world more than we're selling to the rest of the world, $68 billion a month, how does that $68 billion end up back in the United States? Because it has to. It's dollars. How does it end up back in the United States? Well, 69% of our motion picture and sound recording industry is now foreign-owned. That's how it ends up back in the United States. 47% of our plastics and rubber manufacturing industry, all the various companies in that industry in the United States, are now foreign-owned. 43% of our mineral product manufacturing, 38% of pipeline transportation in the United States. Our financial securities companies, our banks, our brokerages, 36% of them are foreign-owned. The companies in the United States that now we're talking about companies inside the United States that are doing things inside the United States. Our machinery manufacturing companies in the United States, 32% of them foreign-owned. All of our coal mines and our oil production in the United States, 30% of it foreign-owned. Chemical manufacturing, 30% foreign-owned. Our total mining, gold mines, silver, the copper, lead, 29% foreign-owned. Equipment manufacturing, transportation equipment manufacturing, 27% foreign-owned. It goes on and on. This is the selling off of America. Over the 10 years from 1995 to 2005, $1.3 trillion worth of American companies were sold to foreign owners. Why? Because of this huge trade deficit, leaving all these dollars in foreign countries and foreign persons, foreign companies' hands. They have to use those dollars to buy something, so they come here and they buy America. $1.3 trillion worth of American companies. For example, in the oil and gas petroleum refining business, Amoco, bought by British Petroleum in the United Kingdom for $48 billion. ARCO, bought by BP, UK, for $27 billion. Texaco's U.S. refining and marketing operations were bought by Shell out of the Netherlands for $3 billion. Pennzoil Quaker State, bought by Shell Oil out of the Netherlands, $2 billion. That's just one industry. That's just oil industry. Amerita Hess, St. Croix Refinery, bought by Venezuela, $932 million. Telecommunications, AirTouch Communications, $60 billion. They were bought by Vodafone out of the United Kingdom. We're selling off this country so that we can keep buying cheap junk from China. It's wrong. 16 minutes past the hour.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight truth.
Yeah, sounds like a deal. Well, how about some truth about what's going on with, for example, steel? Now, this may seem like, you know, kind of, oh, gee, this is policy wonk stuff. No, it's not. This has to do with whether or not you're going to have a job next year.
Well, it's foreign trade stuff. What do you do?
Well, this is going to have to do with whether or not you can afford to buy food next year. This is the stuff that's going to determine whether we're even a country 10, 20 years from now. Chandler in the chat room. Tom, why would it be better for us to pay four times as much for non-Chinese good? By the way, it's not junk. No, a lot of it's not junk. It would be better for us to pay four times as much if it was made in the United States because it would mean that there would be 20 times as much money circulating in the U.S. economy. Don't you get it? When profits are going offshore, profits are going offshore. We want to keep them here. I'm not suggesting that we should just put up a wall and say, no, we're not going to interact with the United States. I mean, with the rest of the world. What I am saying is that we need to be doing this rationally. For example, in April 2005, the International Steel Group, ISG, one of the largest steel mills in the United States, represented 15% of all raw steel production in the United States, 40% of flat-rolled steel production in the U.S., a company that represents 40% of our flat-rolled steel. That's the stuff you use to make tanks. That's the stuff you use to make cars. That's the stuff you use to make trucks. That's the stuff you use to make pipelines. It just goes on and on and on. 40% of all the production in the United States in one sale for $4.5 billion left the ownership of the United States and went into the hands of a guy named Lakshmi Mittal in India. Mark Reuter wrote a book about this, actually. It's called Making Steel. In that book, he notes, Mr. Lakshmi Mittal now owns 40% of flat-rolled steel production, the heart of the Midwest steel industry. He can raise prices, justified or not. He can limit production, justified or not. He can exert enormous pressure over governments. He can move production offshore to extremely low-cost operations he's gobbled up. See, keep in mind, this guy owns steel mills all over the world. Not one word from the Bush administration or most members of Congress about this. Mittal Steel exercises now complete dominance of key Midwestern steel markets after they bought Ohio-based ISG. This was on April 15th of this year. This includes ownership of the ex-Acme steel plant in Riverdale, three of the four sprawling mills on Lake Michigan and Indiana, the ex-Inland Steel's East Chicago Works, ex-LTV Corporation's Indiana Harbor Works, and ex-Bethlehem Steel's Burns Harbors Works. See, because Reagan suspended the Antitrust Act, the Sherman Antitrust Act, in 1982, ISG was able to buy up all of these companies, and since Clinton suspended our ability to have tariffs and to protect our domestic industries, this foreign company, well, here it is, controlled by an Indian family based in London with corporate headquarters in Rotterdam, Netherlands, Mittal Steel now owns the last major mill on Lake Erie, Cleveland, and the nation's only Tidewater plant in Baltimore. Equally remarkable is how little anyone knows about the new owners of the American steel industry. Expanding in warp speed from a single steel mill in Calcutta, this family has purchased 35 steelmaking facilities around the world, mostly in third world and Soviet bloc countries, ex-Soviet bloc countries. Last December, Lakshmi Mittal paid himself a $2 billion dividend from his own private company, LNM Holdings, before merging it with publicly traded Ispat International to form Mittal Steel. In Kazakhstan, where 23 miners died December 5th in a coal mine operated by a Mittal subsidiary, the Trade Union Federation had proposed, quote, extremely low wages and other acute problems, including work speed-ups and job cutbacks at Mittal's Carmet Works. This is the guy now who runs our steel mills. Named by Forbes magazine the third richest person in the world with a net worth of $25 billion derived from his steel empire, Lakshmi Mittal staged a multi-million dollar wedding celebration for his daughter at the Palace of Versailles last July. A month later, widow's benefits were eliminated at Ispat Inland in East Chicago, Indiana, a steel mill. He throws a multi-million dollar wedding for his daughter, and then he eliminates widow's benefits for the widows of men who died in the steel mill that he just bought in East Chicago, Indiana. Well, he didn't just buy it. He bought it in 1998. Shouldn't we in the United States have some say over what we're doing in the United States? Well, the problem is, it isn't that, I see, if we were tomorrow to say, okay, foreign owners can no longer buy, American companies. Well, then you got a real problem because we want to buy $68 billion a month worth of stuff from China, for example, because the labor's cheap there. We want to buy all kinds of cheap stuff from China. We don't want to make it here because we don't want to pay decent wages to workers here. But we're not selling anything to the world because we're not manufacturing anything. In the 26 years since Reagan came to the presidency, when Reagan came to office, we were the largest exporter in the world of manufactured and finished goods and the largest importer of raw materials. We were a fully developed industrialized country. Today, after 26 years of insane conservative economics, we are the largest importer in the world of finished goods and the largest exporter of raw materials. We ship out wood and raw minerals, and we bring in TV sets and cars. That's wrong. 27 minutes past the hour.
And that big old building was a textile mill. It fed our kids and it paid our bills, but they turned us out and they closed the doors. We can't make it here anymore. See those pallets piled up on the loading dock? They're just gonna sit there till they rot, 'cause there's nothing to ship, nothing to pack, just busted concrete and rusted tracks. Empty storefronts around the squares, a needle in the gutter and glass everywhere. You don't come down here unless you're looking to score. We can't make it here anymore. And the bar is still open, but man, it's slow. The tip jar is light and the register's low. The bartender don't have much to say. The regular crowd's getting thinner each day. Some have maxed out all their credit cards. Some are working two jobs and living in cars. Minimum wage don't pay for a roof. Don't pay for a drink. If you gotta have proof, just try it yourself. Mr. CEO, see how far 5:15 an hour will go. Take a part-time job at one of your stores. I bet you can't make it here anymore.
It's the pill that will help you escape the matrix. The Tom Hartman radio program. Welcome back. 35 minutes past the hour. See, this is real simple. You know, let's say that you and I live next door to each other. And I say to you one day, you know, I really like that chainsaw you got over there. How about I buy it from you? And you say, okay, fine. Fine. What are you going to give me? I say, well, I'll give you an IOU. And he says, okay, fine. And you say, okay, fine. So I give you the IOU, and I got the chainsaw now. And then I say, hey, you know, I really like that TV you got over there. That's kind of cool. And you say, fine, well, you know, what are you going to give me? Well, I'll give you an IOU for it. And we keep doing that until I've bought all kinds of stuff from you. In fact, let's say you're making stuff in the back. You're making TVs and chainsaws. And I keep buying them, whatever it could be. And I keep giving you my IOUs. And eventually you're going to come around to me and you're going to say, you know, I got all these IOUs. I want something. And I'm going to say, well, you know, what have I got that you want? Well, I'll take your front yard. And but I still have some of your IOUs. I'll take your front porch. I'll take your front door. I'll take your car. I'll take your driveway. And I'll take the back of the house. I'll take the side of the house. I'm going to take the roof, too. And pretty soon I'm down to living in one room that you don't own, right? I mean, that's how we have been reacting to the interacting with the rest of the world. With this insane trade policies. And you know who's making out like bandits in all this? The multinational corporations. The interests of the United States were screwed. The interests of the middle class were screwed. The multinational corporations, they're getting richer and richer and richer. 52 of the largest, of the 100 largest economies in the world are multinational corporations. They're no longer countries. It shouldn't be that way. Countries have lost their ability to be sovereign. We are in debt not just to China, not just to England, not just to Saudi Arabia. We are in debt. The United States, as a nation, is in debt to Mexico. And so they can come into the United States and say, you know, we're going to buy that auto factory. We're going to buy that publishing company. One of the best-selling books that I've written, back 97 I wrote it, Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, about the peak oil. The book is still selling really, really well. It's published by Random House. Random House is owned by Bertelsmann, the largest publisher in the world, out of Germany. I mean, you just go through the list. Telecommunications. I told you about AirTouch, bought by Vodafone, $60 billion. VoiceStream Wireless, bought by Deutsche Telekom, $29 billion. AT&T Worldwide Assets Operations, bought by British Telecom, $5 billion. GE Americom Communications, bought by SES Global out of Luxembourg, $4 billion. That's just telecommunications. Transportation equipment. Chrysler was bought by Daimler-Benz in Germany for $40 billion. ITT Industrial Automotive, bought by Valeo SA in France for $1.7 billion. Allied Signal, the auto braking company. I remember Allied Signal in Michigan growing up. It's one of the manufacturers. It's now owned by Robert Bosch GmbH, GmbH in Germany. $1.5 billion. Moved to printing and publishing. Harcourt bought by Reed in the UK, $5 billion. Simon & Schuster, bought by Pearson in the United Kingdom, $4 billion. West Publishing, bought by Thomson in Canada, $3 billion. And that list goes on and on. I mean, just pick an industry. Mine, Magna Copper, is bought by BHP in Australia, $2.5 billion. Insurance, John Hancock Insurance Company, the guy whose signature opened the Declaration of Independence. John Hancock Insurance Company, bought by Manulife in Canada for $11 billion. You think your insurance company is American? Transamerica Group, bought by Aegon NV in the Netherlands for $9 billion. Farmers Insurance Group, you think you're a farmer? Yeah, I'll buy it from Farmers. That's owned by Battis Inc., BAT Industries, PLC, United Kingdom, bought for $5.2 billion. And on it goes. I mean, the American Banking Insurance Group. It's owned by a Belgian company. They bought it for $2.6 billion. Drugs, Smith Kline. You think this is a U.S. company? No, I'm sorry. They're owned by the United Kingdom now, $7.9 billion. Machinery. You know, I mean, this list, I could go on forever. I mean, it is over $1 trillion just in the last 10 years. And so you go to work for Honda, and gee, isn't it great? They're insourcing, Tom Friedman would say. Yeah, they're building factories here. But why are they building factories here? So that they can make a profit. Where does that profit end up? Not in your pocket, not in my pocket, not in the pocket of the United States. It ends up in Japan. This is, you know, the DLC loves this. The Republicans love this. The corporations love this. And who's getting screwed? The middle class. This is why they don't need a middle class anymore. Because they've got this new world order. And it doesn't work. It just doesn't work. Angela, is it Angela in Seattle?
It's Angelia.
Angelia. Hey, Angelia.
Well, nice to speak with you, and you're a wonderful man, I wanted to tell you.
Thank you.
I wanted to actually speak about products made in China.
Mm-hmm.
My dad had bought some cute little lamps for our girls for Christmas a few years back, and they claimed to be UL listed, which is United Laboratories, or safe within the
Underwriters Laboratories. Yeah.
Right. Thank you. And yet this lamp made in China started a house fire in our house, and the fire marshal confiscated it because it was illegal to fire hazard. So, you know, yes, they may be cheap, but they come with a hefty price.
Mm, good point. Angelia, thank you very much for sharing that story.
You're very welcome.
Good to hear from you. Barbara in Hayward, California. Hey, Barbara.
Hi. I love your show. I love Air America, and I am a Democrat, and I make sure all of my kids are registered. Now I'm going into my grandkids. And when my great-grandchild, she will be registered to vote Democrat.
Oh, good on you, Barbara.
Let me tell you something. I worked 47 years in the medical field and a union worker.
There you go.
And my granddaughter graduated, and she is now a nurse, and she's in the nurses' union.
Good on
And her. I babysit my granddaughter so she could go to school. My great-grandchild. In fact, I paid her to let me watch her.
Oh, isn't that? That's great. That's great.
While she was still in school.
Louisa
I Sumner. Love America, and I will never shop at Walmart and never have.
Yeah, well,
when
good.
I walked in and saw China, I walked out.
Yeah. Well, good on you. Thank you very much for calling and sharing that with us. Louise is sitting here grinning. My wife. We're still hoping for grandchildren one of these days. We'll see. 1-866-440-8466. Rebecca in Edmond, Washington. Hey, Rebecca.
Hi. How are you? Last night I was watching Hardball, and Lisa Caputo was on. She was press secretary to Hillary Clinton when the Clintons were in the White House.
Right.
And when Chris Matthews complimented Howard Dean for all of the work that he had done, she jumped right in and said, oh, no, no, it was Rahm Emanuel that should get all the credit for this. And I started thinking about her, and I did a little research, and I found that she is now with Citigroup, and she was put in charge of something called Women and Company. She's the CEO of that division of Citigroup. She's also on the Council on Foreign Relations. And if you look at who's on that, they are the muckety-mucks of the corporate world, of the Democrats, especially Democrats.
Yeah, exactly. What we're looking at here is the takeover of sovereign nations by multinational corporations. You know, the conservatives back in the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, well, actually all the way back to the teens when they started fighting the idea of the League of Nations. And Woodrow Wilson fought so hard to get the U.S. into the League of Nations throughout his presidency, throughout World War One, and after World War One, and he was unsuccessful because the Republicans said, no, we will not go into the League of Nations because we'll have to surrender some sovereignty. We will lose the power to declare a war without the approval of the world. And these same guys who are so hysterical about the loss of U.S. sovereignty over whether or not we can make war have no problem with the loss of U.S. sovereignty over whether or not we can have a middle class and we can have decent jobs. And it makes me crazy. I'm telling you, it's just wrong.
And even though people like Rahm Emanuel, representing the DLC and the Clintons, DLC, have done a lot of good work, and they have helped us get back the House and the Senate, we have to really work on this right now and coming up before 2008.
Yeah, and it's not about picking on Rahm Emanuel or Hillary Clinton or any of these folks. I frankly think that if we can make the parade big enough, they'll all join it. I really think they will.
I think you're right. And I want to just mention that yesterday on another subject but related, I received a letter from a hearing examiner. I was a party of record on stopping Walmart in Mill Creek, Washington, and they are not going to be able to build their Walmart, and we're very happy about that.
Hey, congratulations.
So another Walmart bites the dust.
That is absolutely great. Congratulations,
yeah.
Rebecca.
Well, a lot of other people get a lot more credit, but we're glad.
Good on you for good
Thank
work.
You.
Thanks a lot for the call. That's great. That is absolutely great. Barbara gets our applause for the day. There you go. Congratulations. Our jolly good fellow. Yep. There. 45 minutes past the hour. Truth and common sense in broadcasting for a change.
The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also on the faces of people going by. I see friends shaking hands, saying, how do you do? They're really saying, I love you.
And welcome back. Thanks so much to my producer, David Poole, to Louise Hartman, to Andrew Dunn, Lauren Kirshner, all the folks at Air America, Clay Kaplis, Alex Goldmark, to Ben and Shelby at White Rose Society, RadioPower.org, to Sue Nethercutt, the folks in our chat room, Mike Toth, who does our audio archives on our website, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for listening to our program. Yeah, it's a wonderful world. Pop that up for a second.
What a wonderful world.
Ah, yes. Thank you. My dad's favorite song, in fact. 9 minutes before the hour, 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Steve in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Steve.
Hey, Tom. I'm having one of those stupid moments where you know you should understand something, but for some reason you're not getting it. I'm trying to get my arms around the problem of these foreign-owned companies. Now, I can understand how Walmart comes into a community and sucks out all the profits at the end of the day and takes it to Bentonville so that the mom and shops that used to own those places, you know, don't have that money anymore.
Right.
But what about when it comes to those larger companies like the steel thing that you mentioned, what's the difference between a foreign-owned and an American-owned? Because basically the foreign-owned company is still paying taxes on the profits, right?
Well, it's not about the taxes. It's about the profit itself. And in some cases, no, they're not paying taxes on that profit. They, you know, they can arrange the distribution of the cash through offshore companies. I mean, this is what Halliburton has done by reincorporating Kellogg Brown and Root as an offshore company, as a foreign company.
Okay.
They did that to avoid paying U.S. income taxes on the money that they're making on these no-bid contracts. But here's the deal. Companies exist to make a profit. I mean, that's the whole point of it. So if that profit stays in the United States, then it grows our economy. If that profit leaves the United States, then it grows somebody else's economy.
But if that profit's being held by, like, you know, these really rich people, I mean, they just invest it foreign anyway.
Yeah, well, that's another small problem we have, and Bush has exacerbated that by saying that if you work for a living, you pay 33% top tax rate, but if you, you know, sit around the pool on your butt waiting for the dividend check to arrive, you pay a maximum 15% income tax.
Gotcha.
But it's the other half of the problem, though. I mean, this one half of the problem has to do with the profits leaving the United States, so basically what's happening is, you know how the U.S. used to run, we used to run banana plantations in Nicaragua.
Yeah.
We used to run pineapple operations in Hawaii. We used to run, you know, it was, I mean, this is, you know, the Belgians used to run rubber plantations in the Congo, I believe it was, the French in Algeria. Basically, the country that is owned, where the industries are owned by some external force, that external force becomes the colonizer. And that's what we overthrew a corporation that owned us in 1776. We threw out the British East India Company. The Boston Tea Party was all about, in 1773, in the winter of 1773, was all about saying to a multinational corporation, no, we're not going to enhance your profits, thank you very much. We've got a bunch of small entrepreneurs here who know how to run their own ships.
Uh-huh.
And this giant tax break that was the Tea Act of 1773 from King George, the colonists said, no, we're not going to do it. So that's half the problem. The other half of the problem is what happens if we get involved in some international conflict and Mr. Mittal with Mittal Steel decides that his interests are not concurrent with ours.
Yeah, and the current administration likes to get in those conflicts.
Well, yeah, and he just says, okay, we're just going to shut down the steel mills.
Gotcha.
Or we're going to raise the price of steel in the United States by 25%. And you can't do anything about it because we own most of the steel. And you know, at that point, then are we going to start nationalizing things? Are we going to go the way of Cuba? You know,
yeah.
I don't think so. I mean, you know, are we just going to get crushed down to our knees? I mean, there are a whole lot of good reasons why you don't want foreign ownership of the major infrastructure and industries in your country. And yet the reason why we have it is not because, you know, Mr. Mittal in India is a bad guy or because the Chinese are evil or anything like that. It's because we have instituted an insane set of trade policies since Reagan came into office that maximize corporate profit by moving manufacturing to low labor cost areas and leaving sales in high retail cost areas. I mean, you know, Nike, for example, or Adidas started making shoes offshore, you know, they didn't reduce the cost of tennis shoes.
Right.
They, you know, Phil Knight became a multi-billionaire. I mean, it's just, you know, and that's, you know, it's really fine. I mean, he was playing by the rules of the game. My argument is not against Phil Knight. It's against the rules.
The lawyers.
It's not even the lawyers. It's we, the people, need to change the rules. And the rules are the law. And we have instituted trade policies that just plain old flat out are not good for the United States. That's the bottom line. So, anyhow, Dale in Kearney, Nebraska. We have less than a minute. Hey, Dale, what's up?
Oh, hi, Tom. Well, love your program as always. And, you know, one of the other aspects of this current domestic economy and when we've seen all these international trade policies being implemented, I believe when we look at the national savings rate in America.
It went negative last year for the first time since the Great Depression.
Absolutely. Here's what I think, and maybe I'm totally off base on this, but as these multinational corporations look at sales, be it domestic, be it international, the handwriting's on the wall. They know that the real market is to go abroad. They've got NAFTA, CAFTA to help them.
Yep, they're strip mining this country, and then they're going to leave.
Exactly. I think they see that America is strip mined out, so they're looking for a new host, if you will.
There you go, and they're the ones doing the strip mining. Dale, thanks a lot for the call. Well said. By the way, tomorrow, Saturday, November 11th at noon on the main stage, I'll be at the San Francisco Green Festival at the San Francisco Concourse Exhibition Center. That's at 8th and Brannan.
And on Monday's program, conservative Michelle Walker and I will take on the immigration debate. Peter Barnes is here about his new book, Capitalism 3.0, A Guide to Reclaiming the Commons. That and more, and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman radio program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. And always remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you Monday.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.